Hello, friends. It's time to drop the needle on another episode of Supersonic Chat. This is a music podcast full of debate, jousts, thought experiments. We do it all in the name of entertainment. My name is Adrian Warhope.
And I'm Leon Leroux. And Adrian, before we begin, may I congratulate you on your new job? I must say, I reckon it feels right for you to be once again in the upper echelons of the music industry, my friend.
I'm back,
like,
baby.
I just think it seems like the perfect place for a certified music obsessive like yourself, I reckon.
Thank you, sir. Feels good. Feels good to be back. Yeah.
Without further ado, my good man, as the keeper of the questions and the crafter of the conundrums for this small ensemble we have, the smallest ensemble, in fact, because we're a duo, what key are we singing in today? What tuning fork should I listen to before we get started? What can you tell me so that our voices can be in complete synchronization, a cappella style today, my good pal?
That was the perfect intro, because today we're going a little somewhere a little different, a little other, a little esoteric. And previously we've done episodes on sad songs, songs of suffering. And recently, on our 69th episode, we did songs of love. This one's a little different. I wanted to do songs of spirituality or spiritual songs or songs of the sublime, something like that, you know, because sometimes music is tangible. It has a physical aspect to it. It makes you move and dance. Yeah. Sometimes music's emotional. Think about beautiful ballads and breakup songs and even silly pop songs. Today, I want to chat about music that falls into the category of other. You know, music that serves a different purpose, music that helps us transcend what we can see and touch and takes us to another place. You ready for a chat? You up for that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hit me. Like, what are we talking about?
Look, it's easy to point
Still sounds very nebulous.
It is by nature. And I want to help frame this up and define it and get stuck into it. But it's a good chat to have.
Okay.
You know, you can point to spiritual music, right? Like Bob Marley's Rastafarian influence, and even Bob Dylan had a couple of Christian albums in the early 80s. But I think there's a bigger, broader, and yet more inclusive chat for us to have. So let's dive in. So let me try a couple of definitions, right? Because it's such an esoteric, hard to define, touchy-feely area. So, you know, of course, spiritual, relating to the human spirit or soul, as opposed to material or physical things. I mentioned that word sublime, you know, which besides being a great 90s, you know, SoCal punk band. And a tattoo that many of its followers get on their neck. 40 ounces of freedom. It's sublime, right? So if you think about beauty relates to the senses, again, you know, and something's beautiful, but something is sublime, it kind of evokes this overwhelming loftiness or vastness,
you know,
and I think it implies elevation or exaltation almost beyond human comprehension. So that's kind of what I'm talking about.
That's what the romanticist artists were trying to achieve in their art making from the early 1800s. They were trying to, you know, because at the time the Enlightenment had just happened, and they were kind of like, well, yes, it's all well and good to try and quantify things, but there's some things that can't be quantified.
Yeah.
And the idea of the sublime, the idea of things that are too much for our human emotions, is something they tried to capture in art, and they particularly tried to capture that through landscape and like the smallness of a person within an enormous and vast landscape.
The
natural world
sense.
Being something that is sometimes too much to grasp.
That's like when you try and think about how big the universe is, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And you go, whoa. Okay.
Yes.
And I guess you're right. You know, for thousands of years, the role of the artist has been in part to access, touch, reach the sublime, to transcend that every day, you know, and access something bigger than themselves. And the artist invites us to be part of that. And that's important. And I want to talk about that today.
There's a good quote, and I think it's by an Australian artist, and I can't remember which one, and he said that the aim of art is to approach the unknowable.
Wow. God, I just want to sit and think about that. That's cool.
Yeah, because it's the wording is really careful. You know, it's like to approach the unknowable. It's not the unknown, but the unknowable, and to get just a little bit closer to it.
To approach.
I wish I could remember who said it.
Leon said it, but.
Sure. I took credit for that. Yes, me. Yeah. I said that.
Yeah. I guess it is a weird space. This is a weird thing for many people to think about or dwell about. But come with us, listeners. Like I want to sit and ponder, and we're going to get to some really interesting examples. First, I've got two questions for you, and then I'm going to jump into a place that I think everyone can relate to. First,
okay, I'd love to.
Some say singing just isn't something many people do these days. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people. That's a really good question. From personal experience, I sing whenever I damn well can. Like I sing constantly.
You do. I've shared a house with you. I've heard you singing, doing the washing up. Yeah,
constantly. And I just enjoy singing. So from personal experience, no. But I think part of what I do understand what you're saying, because I think singing is a moment where you are vulnerable. And I think it is a moment where you can, people can be judgy people are judgy when you're singing.
Yes.
And they're judging the quality of your singing. And so I think people feel a little self-conscious when they're singing. And you know me, I don't generally just feel very self-conscious as a general rule. So I guess that sort of thing is not something that sort of
you're
factors
a unique
in for
individual.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah. Like if I'm singing in the car and the window's down, I don't care if other people hear me. It doesn't matter to me because that's not what I'm doing it for. Right.
Yeah.
It's not about what others are thinking. It's about the experience and the feeling that singing gives me. But I think for a lot of people, they're feeling like if they sing, they're actually performing.
Yeah. Okay. This is very interesting stuff. Second question, or thought. I've heard people say or make the claim that men in particular hate singing in public. Thoughts on that?
Well, as a teacher, I've taught boys for a long time, and I would tend to agree that boys don't like. When you're running a school musical or a school choir or something like that, it's very hard to get boys to sing and men to sing. It's certainly possible. Like in a school I used to teach at, it was actually compulsory for the rugby team to do a performance at the end of year assembly. So there was the rugby choir that would do a performance at the end. Yeah,
I love that.
Isn't it great?
That's such great.
It's a way to try and get the boys to connect with a really vulnerable personal thing and to do a performance. And it wasn't like pop songs that they'd be singing. It was real good proper choir songs. And it was also kind of a way, I guess, to inject that kind of sensitive quality to a rugby team. And it's also a great way for them to kind of connect with one another too.
Yeah.
But I think that, boys, I think, and men tend not to sing quite as much as girls or women. It's a lot easier to get girls auditioning for a musical part in a school than it is to get boys.
Yeah,
I think that, there's also like a bit of a stigma, that it's not a manly thing to do. I mean, I totally disagree on a personal level, but I think there's a social stigma.
Yes.
That's a great question.
Keep those in mind as I tell you this story. Everything you've talked about there, judgment, men, and performance, all these kind of aspects of music. And we're talking about spiritual, sublime music's role in taking us elsewhere, accessing, approaching the unknowable. Here's a story. Back in March of 2017, 80 people turned up to a Brisbane pub, your hometown called The Bearded Lady. To sing the song Slice of Heaven, which if you are an Australian or New Zealand listener, you will know. If you're not, please look it up because it's a catchy 1986 tune by Dave Dobbin, a Kiwi. The participants weren't trained singers. They were not a practiced choir. They didn't really know what they were doing. They had just responded to an invitation from a lady called Astrid Jorgensen, who's a singer and a conductor. And they were going to perform an ad hoc choir. And in quotes, to help regular people reclaim music in their lives free of pressure or judgment. That's pretty cool, right? And pub choir was born.
Yeah, so, it's funny you should say this. I was just talking to a friend of the pod, Stuart, recently, who has participated in pub choir.
Okay, because it's a thing now, right? So, you know, Slice of Heaven, it has that da 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 ba, boom, da da da.
Yeah.
Perfect for untrained singers. Yeah, there's a whole refrain. So that's a great song. You know, so at the event, it was a rousing success. They taught it to the audience in three-part harmony. And after a few run-throughs, they performed the number, which was filmed and shared on social media. And they do it again. They've done it for and now it's a ticketed event. A massive, you can buy a ticket, it sells out. They do it at the Enmore in Sydney, I think. So big audiences that pay money just to go and have a drink, learn a song, and perform. You can look it up on YouTube. It's killer. They've done Zombie by the Cranberries. They've done Creep by Radiohead, Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus. All these things that I've done by the Killers. They did a great version of Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush. And it's just
apparently they've done the song formerly known as by Regurgitator.
Oh, that would be so good.
And apparently they had a member of Regurgitator on the stage as a guest. I can't remember which member, but then they had him as a guest, and it sounds amazing because they've got somebody who is there, an expert, to know, okay, you're going to be soprano, you're going to be alto, tenor, etc., and put them all into different sections.
Yes,
and you know, they practice it, but you know, basically between drinks, just practicing singing together.
Yep.
And apparently it started as a really small pub thing, like you said, but now it's massive.
Yeah.
Now it's huge.
The cool thing is that they talk about this as a chance to build a community and share joy with strangers.
Yes.
Singing feels great. This is a judgment-free zone. You know, come and sing. They're like, you're not going to be heard. It's relaxed. It's supportive. You know, then they talk about everyone can sing. Not well, but literally, everyone can sing. You know, so why, this is good, why should being average at something stop you from doing it? You know, singing is good for you, it's easy.
Yes.
And they do, and this is let me hit you with this bit. It says, with a show that is equal parts music, comedy, and beer, pub choir is a euphoric sensation that transforms a crowd. And I just wanted to think about the spiritual, sublime nature of music, of an experience that helps you transcend. It's more than emotions, it's more than actions. There's something else there. And some of the key things was the song choice doesn't matter, really.
But having said that, that pub choir has done a Coldplay song, like I think it was called Yellow or something. I think I might not enjoy that.
Come on, great. No, to sing it, you probably would love it.
It's a bit tongue in cheek. I probably would, because it's probably just, it's not about the song itself.
Yes.
It's not about the complexity of the song. It's about that shared experience. Yeah. I totally get it.
Yeah. And like, skill doesn't matter. The skill doesn't matter.
Yeah. And it's, that's reminded me where you're saying skill doesn't matter of a really great Kurt Vonnegut quote.
Oh, yeah. Slaughterhouse Five, great author. Yep.
Oh, he's a genius. And he's got lots of great things to say. And there's this wonderful thing that I love to remind myself of all the time, because it's not about being good at it or being expert at it or even making money out of it. Mm. He says, this is the quote, go into the arts. I'm not kidding. The arts are not a good way to make a living. They are a very human way of making life more bearable. Practice an art. No matter how well or badly, it's a way to make your soul grow, for heaven's sake. Sing in the shower, dance to the radio, tell stories, write a poem to a friend, even a lousy poem. Do it as well as you possibly can. You'll get an enormous reward. You'll have created something.
Yes.
How good is that?
Kurt Vonnegut. Yeah.
I know. He's a genius. He's a brilliant genius. And that's the thing, right? It doesn't matter how good you are at it. You're not, it's not about being an expert. It's about creating something. And particularly when you're singing together, it's about creating something that everybody is a part of and that you kind of can share in that communal understanding together.
Yeah. And I liked the word euphoric, right? Euphoria.
Yes.
It's bigger than joy. It's bigger than a feeling. It's something larger than ourselves. And I love that.
I think euphoria is related to the sublime, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think it's intrinsically one helps the other.
Yeah.
You know, it's awesome. And the other thing I liked is that it wasn't a passive activity, right? So listening to music, looking at art, you know, sometimes it's a really passive activity that you just sit and allow to happen. But I liked the requirement of participation, of interaction, of a practice, of doing something that relates to spiritual and helping us ascend, you know, transcend and reach a place bigger than ourselves.
So pub choir is obviously not necessarily inherently spiritual, but I've got a clarifying question for you.
Yeah.
Are you going to include karaoke as part of this? Like, it's a communal singing thing, but one person's on stage. Like, it's pretty, I think it's different, but.
Yes.
I
think there's a key. You're right. It's the cousin of, but there's one key differential, the performative nature of karaoke, right? There's a performative nature. Whereas I think with pub choir, it is not a performative nature. It's like a participatory practice experience rather than look at me, watch me, let me do something for you. It's like pub choirs, we're all doing this together, and that's powerful in a spiritual way.
I think that's the big difference, right? Is that you're not looking at one person, particularly as pub choir, you're just looking at the conductor, you know, the person who's doing the thing on the stage, and that person's not the performer at all. That person's just the one who's keeping the whole mass together. Yeah. Whereas karaoke, it's just, you know, you're looking at your screen. Yeah. And it's about the one person performing rather than the community doing one thing together.
But karaoke, too, great karaoke is done in a supportive, judgment-free environment where you got friends and your mate who cannot hold a tune is just belting out, living on a prayer, out of tune, and you are like going, yes, champion.
And everyone else is cheering this guy. Exactly. I'm going, absolutely. On board with your terrible singing.
Yes. And that's the community aspect, which is similar to pub choir. But it does have that performative element. And I think participatory nature and of us all together as one is something transcendent that is kind of cool. So I just wanted to start there because I think we can look for the sublime.
That's a lovely way to frame the whole thing, Well, I've got to tell you, I've always loved singing and I've always loved communal singing because, like, I remember in year one, like as just a six-year-old boy, we had compulsory choir tryouts and all my mates, they just deliberately threw their audition. They just sang the worst they possibly could because they're like, I don't want to go to choir. You know, like going back to what you were saying about blokes not wanting to sing, these guys didn't want to sing. Partly it's probably because they knew that rehearsal was at lunchtimes, but again, like I think there's a bit of stigma to it. But I think there was stigma to it. And there wasn't lots of boys in the choir at all. Like mostly it was girls. Mm. And I joined in year one and stayed in there all through primary school. And I think I only missed a couple of rehearsals the whole time. And like if they had a choir in high school, I probably would have joined in with that too.
Awesome.
Were you in the choir?
No, but again, because you know, I'm a attention seeker somewhat. I joined the school musical and I had all singing, all dancing roles as leads in school musicals. And I'm not singer and I'm not a great dancer, but
yeah, but you got yourself out there.
I carried my, it was great. I loved it. That were good.
Well, I do have an embarrassing story about when I missed choir practice a couple of weeks in a row because I had like a cold or flu or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might have been when my sisters both got chicken pox and I was trying to desperately get it or something like that. I don't remember. It was I never got it, but it was year five or six. That was around the time. But as the choir, we would like lead national anthem all the time for big assemblies. And there was a big evening assembly coming up, like some awards ceremony or something like that. Probably end of year academic awards or something. And as you rightly know, our national anthem has two verses. And
yes.
Previously, our song had sung both of these verses at big events for, you know, the whole time I was in primary school. But little did I know, the choir, you know where this is going, had decided to cut the second verse for that assembly. And in fact, indefinitely. And to give you context, when the teacher says to the choir students, sing as loud as you can, most students, they just, you know, they sing audibly.
Yeah.
Whereas I took the instruction as gospel and I made my voice carry far and as loud as I could.
Yes.
And you know my voice, like,
yes.
I project.
Yeah.
So I like to, I guess it's a bit like runner's high when I'm projecting my voice
or something like that.
Yeah, it's like that. You get that adrenaline feeling. And so I just.
Second verse comes around and out Leon just goes.
And I'm like, in joyful strains, then let us sing, advance Australia fair, beneath. I was the one and only person singing beneath our radio.
In pure silence,
and complete silence. Oh. And I was mortified. But at the same time, in retrospect, it's also objectively funny.
Yeah, that is well played, sir. Well played, definitely. You know, singing, like congregational singing is awesome. I've had wonderful times, you know, spiritual times, transcendent times being part of congregational singing. You know, something powerful about, you know, you're all singing the same song. You're all, you know, postured the same way. You're intaking breath at the same time and you know, the vibe. You know, noise is vibrations. There's vibrations in the air of everyone singing, and it's an amazing sense of community, and you know, it's brilliant. That was really good.
Yeah.
The other example I had, and you'll laugh at this, is you may or may not know. I do love Australian rules football, and every Australian rules football team has a team song. Australian rules football has been around for 150 years. And they have these songs. You only sing the song if you win the game. So at the end of the game, and I guess, you know, the cathedral of the everyman is the sporting arena, you know?
Yes. Yes.
And
well, the soccer, all the soccer clubs have got songs about individual, not only their soccer club, but they've got about individual players and all kinds of things like chants and stuff like that.
They do, and some of them are absolutely filthy and disgusting and hilarious.
Yeah.
Less spiritual.
I like
this
idea of only singing if you win, though.
Yeah. So you sing when you win, and at the end of the game, the full-time siren goes and the song starts. And they are traditional songs, like they're old songs. So team, the Sydney Swans, they've borrowed – their song is called Cheer, Cheer, the Red and the White, and they've borrowed the Notre Dame Victory March, which was written in 1905. So they're all – common, most of them are common songs that they've just reappropriated 120 years ago and made their own.
Cheer, cheer the red and the white, honor the name by day and by night, lift that noble banner high, shake down the thunder from the sky.
But I guess what I wanted to say about this, again, transcendent, this is where songs become much more than entertainment. Songs become much more than art. You know, there's something about this being the DNA of a tribe of people. It's something that unites people, you know, very different, very dispersed people. It unites them. And I tell you, last year, the Sydney Swans won this game that got them into the big grand final by 1 point. They were ahead. Collingwood Magpies came back. It was packed out at the SCG. I was beside myself. It was exhilarating. And when we won by 1 point, the siren goes and they played that song. I tell you, it was like I was outside of my body. And it's weird talking about this as sport, but my family was there. My friends were there. And there was the opposition. People were crying because they'd lost. There was my team crying because we'd won. And we went somewhere bigger than ourselves just for a moment, for a glimpse. You know, we approached that something else that was just exhilarating. It was just like the juice of life.
Also it's like that. Going back to the idea that it's a something you sing when you win, this whole thing this whole game has like taken you on a roller coaster of emotions. Yeah. And for our international listeners, Aussie Rules football is a big scoring game. To lose, to win by 1 point is almost a miracle.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you score 120 points sometimes in a game. It's a huge scoring game because you win 6 points for kicking it in the center and 1 point for kicking it either side of the center.
Well done, Sporting Leon. This is excellent.
Yeah, well, I did play some Aussie Rules when I was a 12-year-old boy, yep. And then gave it away because I, you know, realized I don't like ball sports. But yeah, it's like a
yeah.
But to win by 1 point is massive, and it is so. It would have been, from what it sounds like, a game that's on tenterhooks the entire time.
Yeah, and they were coming back, so it was like, oh my gosh, we've been winning the whole game by a lot, and now we're going to lose. Oh my gosh, you know, roller coaster. Absolute
and
roller coaster.
After that roller coaster, the reward of the song and then feeling absolutely completely united in the tribe. It's not a frivolous thing. This is like a transcendent experience.
Yeah. And you can, so imagine no song. Siren goes, we're beside ourselves, we're high-fiving, we're cheering. I might have hugged a couple of strangers around me. And then it dissipates, right? Dissipates and you're talking to your people you know.
It'd be almost like an anticlimax.
It would have been awesome. But when the whole so your tribe is singing. When your tribe is up and singing, you are connected with everyone right across the stadium.
Yes.
Singing this song, and it's this shared experience of joy. Yeah. And it's, you know, I feel a little weird talking about sport in this way, but I guess sport's a great unifier, regardless of religious persuasion.
Probably because you're also aware that I don't get sport as well. So you're like,
maybe, but that it's just something that I was trying to think of, and I don't necessarily put too much thought. I just like to, if we have a topic, I don't overthink it. I just let things bubble up. And if that's a thought that happens, well, that's something that I want to talk about. And straight away,
powerful experience.
Sydney Swans came up. I coach a team of 12-year-old boys in the down at my local footy club, and we sing a different song. So for boys that turn up that don't know each other to sing a song like your rugby team doing the choir, it's a great unifying experience to go, okay, this is our team song, boys. There's bonding, you know, as well.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And you know, even to a certain extent, Christmas carols are kind of similar. Like right around that same time of year, everyone starts singing Christmas carols. And, you know, again, I don't really like Christmas carols, but I get it. Get it. It's like a rite of passage that marks the end of the year.
Yep.
And you do something together that doesn't happen at any other time of the year. Like if someone's singing a Christmas carol in like July or May, people, you go like, what are you doing?
No.
Why are you wrong. So, why are you being weird? Don't do it. You know?
Yeah.
And again, I think it's also a way to break down barriers of inhibition in that space and have a place where it's okay to sing loud and bad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And that's part of that role that art and music play, is uniting people to transcend. So it's transcend and include. You know, you want to kind of reach out and approach the unknowable, but it's not a solo thing. It's like, let's include everyone. Let's go together. There's something important about that, interesting about that, powerful about that. I had Christmas carols down as well as something that unites people. But yeah. In our culture, I know Christmas isn't celebrated globally, but in our Western Anglo-Christian culture.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's Western. It's related to ancient Rome from Saturnalia, which was a celebration of the god Saturn. And courts and like other essential jobs were just closed down for Saturnalia so everyone could get involved. And so like everybody, no matter what your position, is involved. And this is actually a day where slaves were temporarily freed for the day.
That's
and in
right.
fact, a slave was often appointed king for a day.
Wow.
And so this is a time when normal rules of life were relaxed or abolished, or actually sometimes reversed. And there was, in effect, no laws that were governed, and people could gamble legally and all sorts of stuff. And this is a quote from a person who was actually there. It says, everywhere there is clapping and singing and playing games, and everyone, slave and freed man, is as held as good as his neighbor.
Wow.
And this is a whole week from December 7th that began on December 17th.
Wow.
And and so it's kind of like related to Christmas and Christmas carols. And this is another quote. Who can sing of the spectacle of unrestrained mirth and the banqueting, the unbought feast, the lavish streams of wine? Ah, how I faint and drunken with thy liquor, drag myself at last to sleep. And apparently Christmas carols, people would just sing at other people's houses during Saturnalia, probably just to annoy people, mostly in mirth, because people are just happy and free and boundaries are down, and suddenly people are singing when they normally wouldn't.
Yeah.
And so I think, and Christmas carols are apparently related to that, because, you know, it happened around that same sort of time of the year, and they just kind of, once Christianity kind of overtook the culture, they just co-opted something that already existed and turned them into Christmas carols instead of Saturnalia singing.
Smart marketing.
You know?
Yeah, the emperor in Rome adopted Christianity and kind of went, you know what, Saturnalia is now Christmas and all that kind of stuff. But I've also enjoyed the Christ-centric nature of Christmas, and that's another different tribe as well, but I enjoy that spiritual aspect of Christmas carols and Christmas as well. I wanted to talk about psychedelics, and I wanted to go down that path.
Okay.
You got anything else before I jump down
here? Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I think that part is just that on the Saturnalia thing, I think because the boundaries are down, suddenly people feel like it's okay to sing, and I think it can work in the reverse way, where if you sing in a communal space, boundaries can come down. So rather like Saturnalia, it was like boundaries are down, therefore we will sing. And I think sometimes if you go, it will work in the opposite way, where if you sing, then it will lead to boundaries coming down.
Then boundaries.
So that's
kind of
where I was going with that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So much things shackle us, expectations, societal norms, roles that we play, masks that we adopt, you know, work. We have work modes and home modes and all these kind of different things. But you're right, potentially, and that's why pub choir is so good, because no one has a rank or a title or a position. Everyone is in together, and the singing breaks down barriers. And I think that's a critical part to approaching the unknowable and transcending and having a spiritual experience is about being unshackled and egoless.
Yes.
And
yes.
You know, transcending in that manner, and singing and music is a really critical part of that. I really like that point. That's excellent.
Yeah. I'd love to talk about some because some songs by bands are clearly designed to get the audience singing.
Yeah.
And I'd like to talk about that because, you know, like you mentioned, it's a great way to unite a tribe.
Yeah.
And sometimes it happens spontaneously, but I think bands actually sometimes deliberately try and create this effect to unite the tribe of their fans. Like Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall.
Because of the the choir aspect or the
yes.
The, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like this song, I think, is practically it feels almost like an anthem or a chant or something like that.
Yeah.
Like it's a call to defiance. And I kind of get the timing of the song too. Like, not because I was old enough to remember it or anything like that, but the year this song was released was 1979. So I was just born. But it's like 5 years from that Orwellian year, 1984.
Yeah.
And like, you know, the revolutions in the 60s and the 70s, the radical 70s had happened. And they got this children's choir to sing, you know, the lyrics like all in all and just another brick in the wall, like feeling like you're just part of like a big machine.
Mm.
And apparently they got this children's choir and they overdubbed this children's choir 12 times to give them an impression of a huge choir of kids.
Wow.
And Roger Waters said this: the lyrics were a reaction to my time at Cambridgeshire High School for boys in 1955 when I was 12. Some of the teachers there were locked into the idea that young boys needed to be controlled with sarcasm and the exercising of brute force to subjugate us to their will. And that was their idea of education. And so he's kind of trying to break this idea, this horribly entrenched idea of what he considers bad education. And they don't need it to be controlled and subjugated. It's like this system's broken and all the kids are singing it. And imagine that at a concert, as if you wouldn't sing that as a huge audience.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, interesting. What else you got? What other songs?
Do you know this song, We're Not Gonna Take It by Twisted Sister?
Yeah. Yes.
When I was like a young boy, like 5 or 6, I saw that video clip and there's a crowd of kids actively rebelling in a school and tying up teachers and stuff like that. And I didn't actually want to do it because I was in kindergarten at the time and I actually loved school. But the idea was mental for me. I was like, what? It's just like a really dumb low budget version of Pink Floyd's song.
Yeah, you know, okay. Like, I see what
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But to me it's dumb. It was dumb fun and I knew it even as a kid. But that song, like, we're not gonna take it. Oh no. And they're all singing it together and all the kids are singing it in the song. And it's designed, I think, for everybody to sing it together.
It's a call to unite, to rally the troops. Yeah.
Yeah. And also it's easy to sing. Like, it's not a complex tune. It's super, super easy to sing. And so everyone can just sing it together real easy. I think it just seems something that's designed to get everyone singing all at once. And what about We Will Rock You by Queen?
Oh, I was going to, that was the one that popped in my mind. You know, the whole stomp and clap and all of that sort of thing. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And again, It's just like a couple of notes. It's not a complex tune that everybody can sing. You don't have to be an incredible singer to actually join in.
Yeah.
And it's just so, so catchy. And like, it's easily the most singable chorus.
Yes.
In one of all of rock's songs in the whole world.
Incredible, you know, and it's similar to football songs that the English would sing or people would sing at football. But also what I like here, and linking this to the spiritual nature or the transcendent nature or the sublime, is the invitation. So the performer goes, okay, I'm going to stop performing and I'm going to invite us all into the one space to join together and you know, be. And I like that. I like that. It's not like, watch me. Now it's like, watch us. Let's be us. I'm inviting you in to something bigger than just me performing. I like that. Yeah. In all those examples that you've got,
where the singer has that moment, which points the mic to the crowd, going, "You guys now."
Yeah, that invitation of the artist to say, "Okay, I'm doing my thing, but now I'm inviting you for us to do our thing. Let's go."
Yeah,
like that's important. Yeah. I like that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And we've all been to those concerts where something special happens and you're like, we're all singing, we're all one, we're all there, something cool's going on. That's that's awesome. Yeah, totally. Very good.
I've got another example quickly, which is it's not exactly a communal singing song, but one that is by that same band that we just mentioned, Queen, which I think didn't used to be a communal singing song, but now thanks to Wayne's World is a communal singing song.
Yes.
Like, I've got a love hate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a bit of a love hate relationship with this song because in its fundamental form, it's treated like as an incredible cultural moment, but I just sort of see it as an exercise in songwriting breadth. And like, it's got lots of cool textures and stuff, but I don't think it's like a culture stopping song. It's just kind of like a bit of fun. But my wonderful relationship with this song is centered around Wayne's World.
Yeah, of course.
And it really, to me personally, just the song actually only starts partway through where Wayne inserts the tape into the car stereo.
I think we'll go with a little Bohemian Rhapsody, gentlemen.
Good call.
That's the start of the song for me.
Yep.
Like, there's like a whole first third of the song that I'm like, oh yeah, sure. Let's
get to the Wayne
actually start. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And now, like, whole groups of people will sing this song in unison, I think, in large part to Wayne's World.
Yeah, 100%. Rebreathe new life into that whole band and that whole song is incredible.
Totally.
Ah, good example. I like it. Indulge me. I don't have any examples of like spiritual songs, but I want to talk about an album and an artist and a little bit about psychedelics, if I can. As music has always played a critical role in psychedelic therapy and ritual. And I guess indigenous people believe it, you know, they have a sacrament or a sacred vehicle to these unconscious realms. So you think about peyote, you think about ayahuasca, cannabis for the Rastafarians, that it becomes a sacrament that combined with song often is used in ritual, spiritual ceremony, right? And it's interesting, you know, that when the South American tribes, the shamans have ayahuasca, they sing sacred songs called Icaros, that Mexican mushroom mystics often use poetic chanting. You think about African tribes using rapid tempo beating drums to sort of help people access something outside of themselves. That's kind of one thing. And I just wanted to talk quickly about, there's this album, right? So there's this artist called John Hopkins. He's an English, classically trained composer and electronic musician. He's been Mercury Prize nominated, Grammy Prize nominated. So serious guy, right? Signed to Domino, cool label. So I was working at a label previously to the one I'm working at now, and we put out his album Singularity. Singularity, think about the explosion of the universe starting from a singularity, which was this kind of opus around, you know, spiritual, you know, whatever it was, transcending the universe, whatever, grandiose expedition into that. But that was a performance thing. So we had his next album coming up, and we're all excited. And what we were presented with was this album called Music for Psychedelic Therapy. That was the name of the album. You can go and listen to it.
Wow. Okay.
And for an electronic artist, he had no beats on this album. It was an ambient album. Yeah. Now, for your more sober listeners, it was a little bit like listening to Brian Eno's Music for Airports. You go, okay, interesting, but
Like Aphex Twin selected ambient works.
Exactly, right? Interesting, but yeah. But the album was designed, and this is what I just wanted to talk about, I guess, was, you know, this is the function and utility of this is key. The same could be said about a running playlist at a certain BPM, but there's something more here, right? You know, the function and utility are key, because he made it to time with a ketamine high. So he'd gone to these caves in Ecuador and recorded some sound and field recordings, and he made this album that was inspired to access altered states. And I just thought it was really interesting, this combination of the function and utility of trying to access spiritual states and using natural psychedelics to sort of access this state, and music being a key part in helping people access that.
Like a thing to unlock it, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's a guide, right? It's a guide.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, a guide is a better word.
Yeah.
So it's like a way to direct the experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so you're not suggesting that we incorporate the taking of ecstasy when we sing the national anthem or anything like that. That's not what you're suggesting.
Might help make it more interesting, but no. And, and like, disclaimer: I'm not a drug user. I'm not a drug guy. No. I've never been a real drug guy, right? Other than you know, caffeine and booze. But I just like thinking about this, and maybe in my later life I will become a massive user of psychedelics. I'm not saying no. They talk about in the spiritual tradition, they talk about onset, ascent, peak, and recovery, right? In these traditions to access altered states. And isn't it interesting that when I thought about that, it sounds like a DJ set, right? So we're going to start a great DJ sort of takes you and guides you and helps you, you know, through onset, right? We're starting up.
Yeah. Ascent, through a real, build, that through a curated experience.
Yeah, peak and recovery. Yeah. So I just thought that was really interesting. And there's a lot of places that are investigating science, spirituality, music, and psychedelics and stuff like that. I found that really
The particular effects of music on the brain that is different to the effect of other things on the brain, like music, we talked about, you know, last year, can help dementia patients come out of their fugue state, you know, out of their catatonic state, because it lights up the brain in a way that nothing else does. And surely there is a relationship between these sorts of altered states of being and how music can affect them.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to have some good scientific studies to understand this really deeply.
Yeah, it's been done. There's a lot of cool stuff out there, and I won't dive too much into it, but I did enjoy reading that and going down that rabbit trail. But it's about access, helping people to access a part of their mind or their being or their ego or their person, their isness, right? That's aside from their identity. It's a little bit, you know, and you got to kind of get a little bit unshackled, and you kind of got to get a little bit other.
But on that, you know, we were talking earlier about communal singing as being like part of the, you know, the death of the ego or the removal of the importance of the self. Apparently psychedelics like ayahuasca can do the same sort of thing where you can, where it will actually have a realization that you are not as important as you might otherwise think in your day-to-day life, that you're part of a bigger macrocosm and you're actually relatively insignificant within that. And you know, communal singing can do that. And apparently psychedelics can do that. So imagine the combination of the two.
Yeah, absolutely. We should probably put a disclaimer out here, you know, listeners, this is not advice. We're just chatting. No. You know, obey the laws of the land and don't be silly. All of these things.
Music especially does do that to me. Like I can really instantly put myself in an interesting state of mind just from really embedding myself with all my mind in a particular listening experience.
My mind, I can get caught up in the busyness of my mind and thoughts and all of that. So, and then, you know, you can dwell too much in your emotions. So I do use meditation and some spiritual practices to help me access other parts of me and to release and unshackle and just find peace and purpose and all that sort of stuff. And I think music, everything we've talked about here about music helping us, the invitation to be united, to have a communal experience, the invitation to be part of the bigger picture, the invitation to transcend what you think and know and touch and feel and access something bigger than yourself that will help you feel a release, to help you feel something bigger, better, interesting. All of that is very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Very interesting to me.
Yeah, me too.
Is it time for a fact of the week?
I feel it absolutely is. That was wonderful. You brought that right back to that transcendent thing and brought it full circle. So I think it's fact of the week time for sure.
There is a company called MindCure, who's an app dedicated to mental wellness using data and AI to create an optimized experience for psychedelic therapy. Here's the interesting fact of the week. They use biodata and feedback from headbands and wristbands that track patients' physiological states in order for therapists to respond in real time with personalized music. So they're using music and psychedelics in therapy, controlled settings, professionals.
Yeah.
And rather than just say, we're all listening to this music, they track biodata and they change music to tailor the experience to the person. So it lets the therapist be the DJ for an individual person. Which I thought was a fascinating fact of how science and spirituality are combining for the betterment of mankind. There you go.
That is cool. I'm going to check that out.
Give that a look.
Sounds really
interesting. There you go. We kind of, look, for an esoteric spiritual discussion, we went to the pub and we went to the footy ground and we went to the caves of Ecuador.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a really interesting, cool chat. That's
real round the world trip.
I love talking about this stuff. Cool. So good chat. Listeners, I'm interested to hear what you thought. Damn. Hit us up on the socials. Tell us your experiences about music and spirituality. You can hit us up at supersonicchat@gmail.com or hit us up on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
And we love to hear from you, dear listeners, whether it's through the socials or through the reviews. So give us a hearty review and add those valuable stars on wherever you find your podcasts. And if you've had as much fun as we've had today, then tell a friend about our magnificent show and spread the supersonic splendor.
I love it. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Leon. That was another episode of Supersonic Chat.